This is Ozarks at Large. You can probably quickly recite the four presidents on Mount Rushmore. Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, and Roosevelt are among the most iconic leaders in the country's history. Beginning today, we'll have a series on what other Mount Rushmores might look like. P.J. Hrabowski asked different experts in the area whom they would choose to be immortalized. The rules were simple. You can pick four and only four figures to be included, just like the real Mount Rushmore. For this first segment, P.J. asked Julie Oliver, an assistant professor of history at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith, which four American women she would give Mount Rushmore status. She began her selection with the second ever First Lady of the U.S., who also happened to be the mother of the sixth president.
My first choice is Abigail Adams.
She cared about women's rights, you know?
Absolutely, and she had a forum to express that to some of the leading figures in the founding of this country, the men that we think of as the founding fathers, not only her husband. And we have the reason we have this wonderful legacy, and we know what she thought was she wrote extensively. It was mainly through personal correspondence with her husband.
Right.
But one thing that stands out to me about her is, and that I always found absolutely fascinating, was that she had some correspondence also that we have access to with Thomas Jefferson as well. And this was not frivolous discussion. It wasn't about household matters. It wasn't a romantic writing of any kind. It was actually also talking about some of the things she would share with her own husband and her concerns about the country and the founding of the country, the state of the country, women's rights, the rights of African Americans, the slaves in the country. And so you have somebody like Jefferson. You don't really think of him in connections with women's rights at all. But maybe her husband was a little biased. He is her husband, so uh-huh. She can have this give and take with him. He knew her intimately. Mm-hmm. But when she has this discussion with Jefferson, I think that gives it a little bit more objectivity because she is obviously recognized by him for having a tremendous intellect.
Okay, now why was she – these were letters to Jefferson?
Yeah, there's some correspondence that's
How did this come about? Were they just good friends? Were they friends through her husband?
Yeah, mainly friends originally through her husband. They meet in connection with the Continental Congress as they were both representatives sent there, the first and the second Continental Congress. So the correspondence, the friendship that she would maintain with her husband when he was separated from her. She remained at home in Massachusetts, and he would be in Philadelphia. That correspondence is a rich legacy that's been left between her and her husband. But as the country is formed and then Jefferson and Adams have to take on new roles after the signing of the Declaration of Independence and there are periods of time, occasions when the two have a chance to meet. In fact, Jefferson's daughter has been sent to stay with the Adams family in Massachusetts for a time as he travels to Europe. Mm-hmm. And so they became acquainted that way. And then later when Abigail Adams joins her husband in France, when they're trying to secure French support for the revolution and monetary support and military support, she obviously has a lot of contact with him at that time as well. And I'm not familiar with all the times after that point, but mm-hmm. they had met personally, but there are also some letters, and we don't know exactly the exchange that happened in the real time in person, but some of these letters, correspondence exist, and he obviously admired her intellect. And that stands out more than her correspondence with her husband, which you might think would be expected almost.
From Abigail Adams, who would be next on your list?
Well, this was a hard decision for me because when we had talked previously, we had both mentioned the suffragettes. And that particular effort to get women the right to vote was a long-fought one. But the reason I couldn't narrow it down to one woman is because I think there were so many women who were pivotal in that. Susan B. Anthony mm-hmm. and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, of course. They're some of the most famous names. But there was also other women Mary Elizabeth Lease, and she was from Kansas and was active in the populist movement in the late 19th century, but that movement also supported women's suffrage, and she was known as a great orator. But because she's from Kansas, she's not as well known as those more more connected Eastern ladies.
That's what I was going to say.
Also, there's an African-American suffragette. She was much more than that. However, her name was Ida B. Wells, and a journalist and author. She was exposing the terrors of lynching that were going on after the Civil War, kind of almost an epidemic of lynching in the United States, against targeting African-American population. But she was also a suffragette. She mm-hmm. she believed that women need the right to vote. So there were so many women, I really couldn't narrow that choice down.
We have to narrow that down to a movement.
Yeah, yeah. I think. And that a lot of women were very involved in.
Thank you for that, too, by the way.
So then my choice would be then, somebody whose national prominence kind of stands out differently would be another first lady, Eleanor Roosevelt. She is really still, I think, the only activist first lady we've had. She supported the New Deal policies of her husband, social welfare issues, again, the plight of African Americans and other poor peoples in the United States. And she didn't just express this verbally or in writing. She actually goes out and visits in Appalachia. She visits towns and meetings that were being held by African Americans, and she got a lot of flack for that.
Okay, right. So we have two first ladies, Abigail right. Adams and Eleanor Roosevelt. What about the next woman? Would this be a first lady?
No, in this case, I've chosen somebody who I think is one of my personal heroes, but not connected directly with politics in any way.
And that's okay.
Rachel Carson. Her story, she was a very bright young woman and really interested in, discovered she's interested in the sciences. And so in an age when not many women went into the sciences, she goes into higher education, receives, I believe the highest degree she ever received was, in fact, a master's in the sciences and biology. Mm-hmm. And she starts her career with the U.S. government, working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And this is in the 1950s, primarily after World War II. And through her research, she was observing, mainly on the fish specimens that they would be collected, and that's part of their work in that service. And she was noticing disturbing anomalies and abnormalities in the fish.
Okay.
And so she becomes very concerned about this, and she starts doing the research to try to trace where this was coming from. That was her job. She'd been paid to do this. And her conclusion in the end is that it's directly connected with, in particular, the post-World War II chemical industry. We had gained so much technical expertise in that area through World War II as military mm-hmm. conflict sometimes promotes the innovative inventions and innovative science in the modern time, and that's focused in the military realm at first, and then it comes into the private sector following World War II. So this is kind of where she traces the problem, and that as these companies are producing these chemicals, that the detritus is being emptied into the waterways, much as in earlier time period, industrial logging was polluting the waterways and ruining watershed for agriculture production and et cetera. But in this case, she's seeing these disturbing chemical reactions that apparently have been taking place in the fish population.
As a marine biologist, yeah.
So she puts all this together, and then she's also going to stress that, well, this is not just going to the fish. This is obviously in the groundwater.
Was she one of the first people to – I mean, she was one of the first people to actually bring this to the public,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And the way she does it in the end is primarily she – she is called to speak publicly in different and in different forums about this. But the main way that this information is communicated to the general public is her writing a book called Silent Spring.
Right.
So you might call her a kind of whistleblower. I don't think in this case she wasn't really – she didn't work with the company. She was working with what was supposed to – an objective source and a branch of the government – an agency of the government, and that's what their job was to monitor these things. And you'd think she would have gotten a little bit more support from them. In historical terms, we say, yes, she was certainly – maybe the first official environmentalist or starts the environmental movement.
So now we have three women on Mount Rushmore. Now we need one more. We've got to kick off the presidents and put on the first ladies and the women scientists. And who do we have next?
Well, the fourth choice was awfully difficult. And I did want to move into more recent times. But as a historian, I still stay in the past. But I finally decided on Krista McAuliffe, who was not the first woman astronaut. She was not the first woman scientist. She was kind of represents the rest of us in my mind.
She was a teacher.
She was a teacher and had been chosen of one of about 1,100 women to be the first teacher that would be trained as an astronaut, a payload specialist, and then she would go into space, and then she was going to take that experience, and then she was going to bring that back to her students and to her classroom and become a better teacher and help her students learn. And her being a teacher, the kind of the unsung heroes right now, is not a very good time overall for teachers in the K-12 setting. I think they're taking a lot of bad press right now at all many levels. And I work with teachers on a daily basis, training them. And so I have a little bit of a soft spot for our teachers in the public schools. I know it's a tremendously difficult job. So if you look at Krista McAuliffe being a teacher and the history of teachers in the United States, it's really as early as the 19th century that you have women taking over the teaching profession, the feminization is called of teaching. Mm-hmm. And it was on purpose. It was a strategy by many school boards and leaders in education for using women, paying them less money, and yet they were wonderful teachers. Mm-hmm. And so even by that point, you have 70% of the teachers being women. And so she represents women and the teachers and also, the middle class, as it were. Maybe the other ladies were a little had more exotic mm-hmm. backgrounds. I think her background's not exotic until we get to this, her being chosen as an astronaut. And maybe we would even, truth is, has she just gone through the mission and it been successful and the tragedy hadn't happened and she died in the shuttle explosion, that we would almost have forgotten her name because she was just a teacher.
Well, I just love the fact that you are recognizing women, just thank you for Mount Rushmore. So today, the women on Mount Rushmore will be Rachel Carson, Abigail Adams, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Krista McAuliffe. Now, these are the opinion of Julie Oliver, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Arkansas, Fort Smith. And Julie, I want to thank you so much for coming in today and doing this. And we really, I hope you come back again. We can talk more about women's history.
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks
so much,
Julie,
for having me.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm PJ Hrabowski.
Our series of Mount Rushmore ruminations will continue Friday when PJ talks to professor and journalist Hoyt Purvis about the four American sports figures he'd nominate for the honor. That's on Friday's edition of Ozarks at Large.